Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. I know it's becoming a trite phrase, but it's true. Students and teachers are going back to a school year like no other. It's true in the lower grades, and it is profoundly so at colleges and universities. The need for masks and social distancing is proving antithetical to the college experience. And even though these students are older and understand the impact of COVID-19 on their world, it is clear they are finding it extremely difficult to fight the natural impulses of young people to be together, to socialize. UNC Chapel Hill took an optimistic approach to the fall semester, welcoming students back to campus, but they soon discovered what other schools around the country did. COVID-19 clusters happen, and that necessitates a shift in plans. And that is why, after a week, and as other schools in the 16-campus UNC system experienced increasing cases of the coronavirus, they sent students home and went online. Charlotte colleges and universities are opening under a patchwork of plans, and we'll hear about them this hour. We're joined by the leaders of three of this area's leading institutions. Sharon Gaber is the new chancellor of UNC Charlotte, the fifth chancellor in the school's history. She took office on July 20th, succeeding the retiring Philip Dubois, and had to take on COVID-19. Sorry about that, but welcome to Charlotte, welcome to the university, and welcome to this group of people who already know each other. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And we welcome back to the program Clarence Armbrister, president of Johnson C. Smith University. Good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
Great. And Daniel Lugo is president of Queens University of Charlotte. Thank you for joining us again as well.
Good morning, Mike. Great to be on Charlotte Talks.
Thank you. Let me begin with a very basic question to all three of you. What is your plan? What are your plans for the fall semester? And I'll begin with our newcomer, Dr. Gaber.
Well, so the University of North Carolina at Charlotte changed our plans, and we announced that last Sunday. We had planned to start face-to-face on September 7th. We announced that we will be online beginning September 7th, and we will continue monitoring the situation. The hope is that October 1st, we will be able to shift to face-to-face.
Okay, and Dr. Armbrister.
Yes, we, like Charlotte, had planned to open face-to-face. As of a communication we sent out to our community in late June. However, after monitoring the adverse effects of the virus and the contagion, when all the indicators started to go in the opposite direction, about a month later at the end of July, we made changes to go to all virtual. So we'll be virtual starting on September 8th.
And Dan Lugo, what's happening at Queens?
Well, Queens, like our colleagues here, we intended to open the fall semester on August 24th in person. Our trustees worked closely with the leadership team, and we had a kind of a call of a go or no go on July 31st. And the indicators around the spread of the virus in our community, our ability to execute on our plan and our testing regimen, and what that student experience was going to look like, came back really with a lot of negative data. And we made that decision on July 31st to go all virtual for the fall. Our intention is to continue with our plan in the spring semester, and that will be an important moment for us to return to campus.
Dan Lugo, what has been the reaction, if you know it, of your student body to this decision to not be there?
Well, I think there have been a number of iterations. Back in March, when we had to make the decision to go remote when the virus was really breaking across the nation, and then again on July 31st. I'm incredibly, pleased with our community's patience with us and that they understand clearly we're making these decisions with the utmost priority of their health and safety. But I guarantee you, I'm not winning any popularity contests. clearly, place-based instruction is the preference for the majority of our students, our faculty, and our staff. So it's with great pain and disappointment that we are pivoting towards online, even though we are doing that quite well.
Clarence Armbrister, I'm sure the situation is similar at Johnson C. Smith, but I'll give you a chance to chime in.
Very, very similar. We work very closely with our board as well. And when we made the decision in late July to revert to virtual learning, you can imagine the disappointment. We were quite frankly disappointed because we know in our hearts that the best place for our students is to be here on campus. But as President Lugo mentioned, the numbers dictated a different result. So I've gotten letters from students, particularly some of our younger students, freshmen. I even heard that there might have been a petition being circulated among the freshman class, and we understand their disappointment. And like both President Lugo and Chancellor Gaber, we'd like to have our students on campus, and we hope to have them back as soon as possible. Quite frankly, however, though, many of our faculty and staff were quite relieved, quite frankly. I think there was a lot of concern among both faculty and staff about the effects of having increased the density on campus in the midst of the contagion and when numbers were going in the opposite direction.
Dr. Gaber, Bonnie Cohn would be very pleased to know that you have the largest campus and the largest student body in the area. So what has been the reaction there of your students, at least?
Yeah, and I'd say it's very similar. We get lots of information from students, faculty, staff who are pleased that we're taking health and well-being very seriously. And we have the feedback from the students that they prefer in-person classes and they really do want the college experience. And so I think for us, we've all talked about patience. We recognize that this pandemic seems to change every day and the guidance seems to change every day. So we have worked closely both with the Mecklenburg County Health Department and as part of the UNC system, we coordinate closely with the president, Peter Hans, of the system to say what is possible. In our discussion with the county health department, they said, we are seeing that we are trending downward. We encourage you to wait a little bit longer. That's how we got to the October 1st. And then shortly before that time, before students move in, we will communicate broadly both with the county health department and with the system office and just say, where are we? Let's make a determination as to whether we can safely move in.
7 days ago on August 20th, you sent out a message to students and faculty in which you referenced other campuses in the UNC system and what they had experienced as they reopened, at which time you extended the ability for students to cancel their housing contracts. And that extension runs through tomorrow. So if students don't want to come and don't want to pay for housing, I guess they can cancel that contract if they do it by tomorrow. Do you know how many students have taken you up on that?
And in fact, we extended it again when we made the announcement on Sunday. So it's extended through September 4th. So it goes a little bit longer. And then we will also extend it should we pivot once more and not be able to open October 1st. We are de-densifying the residence halls. We have moved and many have canceled it. Our goal now is to be able to have one student in each room so that it would be single room occupancy to limit the potential spread of the virus should somebody contract it.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Johnson C. Smith University, as UNC Charlotte, brings in students from I'm sure all three of you do, but I'm going to pick on you, Mr. Armbruster. They bring students in from all over North and South Carolina and Georgia and Florida, the DC area, which means the Maryland and Virginia suburbs of Washington as well. Are you offering something similar to students who have paid for housing?
Absolutely. We will return housing deposits, 50% for any student that when we open and as we anticipate opening in the spring, if they have housing. But we will not be charging students, obviously, for housing or for room and or board, food services, if you will. But that has some significant financial implications for an institution as well. And it's a multi-million dollar swing in our operating results. So these decisions aren't taken lightly. And I do want to commend our board, who, when we made the decision to go to virtual, they made it without regard to the finances. They left that for me to figure out.
Lucky you.
Very kind.
Yeah. I'm going to talk about the financial implications of what's happening here around the country with institutions like yours because of COVID-19. But Dan Lugo, Queen's University, you too have suspended in-person classes. What are you doing for your students who have housing?
Well, we refunded or did not charge for the fall semester, and we didn't stop there. The general fee that we would typically charge that would go to cover many of the charges related towards the campus-based experience was also either not charged or refunded, depending on whether a family had paid. So it's a very, very transparent process, and we're trying to be as family-friendly as we can. Even in the face of having what President Armbruster has identified, a significant hit to the operation budget for this fiscal year.
Dr. Gaber, you're offering students, this may have changed, but the last I heard, you're offering students who have made provisions for on-campus housing an opportunity to remain in that housing, even though the classes are online. Is that still the case?
We do have some students on campus because they were beginning their studies or practicing with athletics or this sort of thing. We are now, during this time period where we are going to be online, we will have some exemptions, students who have traveled from out of state or out of the country. So students go through a process to request the opportunity to be on campus.
As I mentioned in the beginning, schools throughout North Carolina and throughout the country, in fact, who decided to open the full-time education on campus quickly made a reversal of that decision in many cases and asked people to leave. Just this morning, it was announced that NC State is closing their dorms today, asking students to leave today. Other schools just seem to be going on with business as normal. Were the schools that decided to open and then changed their minds, including yours, were they operating on an abundance, an overabundance of optimism, wishful thinking, or simply not understanding that when you bring students in from all over the country, you're going to bring whatever exposure they've had from all over the country to one single location? I'll start with you, Dr. Gaber.
I think the first part is, were they overly optimistic? I think everybody wants to get back to face-to-face. I think what we've done is try to follow what does the data say, what are the experts saying, and make sure that we work with that and do it in advance so that students aren't harmed by it. We did an announcement early enough so that a majority of our students hadn't moved in and then we didn't have to pivot. So I think as long as we're following the expert advice and the data, we are better served.
Same question to you, President Armbruster.
Yes, I wouldn't say that they were overly optimistic. It depends on what weight they gave in their calculus of the decision. We certainly included that as part of our calculus, but as President Lugo mentioned, other factors that resulted in our decision were related primarily to the significant amount of contagion in the area at the time. The numbers were going absolutely in the wrong direction. And our ability to withstand an outbreak on campus was evaluated. And when we made our evaluation, we determined that because it wasn't a matter of if you're going to get a case, it was always a matter of when. And when we did the calculus, and if we had a relatively minor outbreak, it would have stressed our quarantine and isolation rooms to an extent that we did not think that it was worth bringing students back under those conditions. So, if you had sufficient numbers of beds and things like that, I think they were fine.
Clarence Armbruster, president of Johnson C. Smith University. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. The pandemic has forced colleges and universities to prepare for an uncertain and unprecedented fall semester. Schools across the state and here in Charlotte have come up with a patchwork of plans to return to classes. Charlotte Talks wants to hear from college students, faculty, and families. How are you feeling about your school's plan? What are your hopes and concerns for this unusual college experience? Leave us a voicemail at 704-802-9967 or visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about what area colleges and universities are doing in the era of COVID-19 with Dr. Sharon Gaber, Chancellor of UNC Charlotte, President Clarence Armbrister of Johnson C. Smith University, and President Daniel Lugo of Queen's University of Charlotte. And just before the break, we were talking about the colleges that decided to go ahead and open, some of whom have stayed open, others have closed immediately. And of those who did they approach this with an overly optimistic attitude or simply an ignorance of what this really would mean if they opened? And I know, Dan Lugo, you wanted to have a shot at that, at answering that question. So go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. We have the unenviable task of managing risk for educating largely a group of 17 to 23-year-olds. So we're constantly managing risk. So I wouldn't accuse any of our colleagues across the nation that opened of being overly optimistic. They were reading the data and their preparedness for opening. Now, there were many fine institutions, places like Harvard and MIT, that didn't make an attempt at all to open. They didn't make an attempt at all. So there was inherently some risk. At Queen's, we made the decision that if we could manage that risk in a strategic way, right, through our planning, that it was worth it. It was worth it. What the go, no-go decision told us, though, is that the size and scope of the risk was beyond the risk we were willing to take. So I think that was a very individual choice and not a reflection on the whole entire industry.
So Dr. Mandy Cohen, who is the Secretary of the State Department of Health and Human Services, says that North Carolina campuses, college campuses, should be doing more to hold students responsible for engaging in activities that can promote the spread of the coronavirus. This doesn't really affect your three institutions because you've all gone virtual. But what is your reaction to that? Dan Lugo, start with you.
Well, I think that actually became one of the factors that we looked at in our rubric. What would the student experience be? Clearly everyone wants to return to campus. But I think perhaps students and families' expectations of what that would look like, as we started evaluating our mitigation and our covenants and all the rest of that, and in light of how intense we would have to enforce those things, We thought that was not the most positive factor, not the most positive factor for their experience, nor for our brand and style of education. Again, worth doing and overcoming if there weren't so much risk involved. But the combination of a diminished experience as well as a heightened exposure risk, again, led us down the path towards going virtual.
But if you hadn't gone virtual, President Armbrister, and you followed Mandy Cohen's suggestion, what would you be doing? How would you encourage students to be responsible? How would you hold them accountable for not being responsible? How would you do that?
In our planning, we developed what we called a social compact, in which we were going to make sure that everyone took the responsibility as not for only themselves, but for the entire university community. And as President Lugo mentioned, we didn't want to be particularly draconian, but the experience of the student was going to be changed in a way that they may not have appreciated, i.e., if they're in their dormitories, no visitors, they weren't going to be allowed to visit other people's rooms, nobody could come onto the campus, and there would be very few, if any, collective social gathering. So our view was that we were going to try to instill throughout the campus, not just the students, but that there was a social compact, and we each had an obligation to one another to hold each other accountable for the health and safety of everyone on the campus. And we would employ whatever means necessary to make sure that the students were adhering to the social compact.
Because we've been seeing video from college campuses around the country where these students seem to be thinking that it's business as usual, and we'll talk about that in a second. But Dr. Gaber, you said a moment ago that you may go back to bringing people back on campus for classroom instruction on October the 1st. That virus will still be around on October the 1st in some form and at some level of infection. How do you plan? I'm sure you're in discussions about this. How do you plan to police that?
Well, I think that is the question. And certainly we're learning a lot from watching our colleagues across the state. We are in conversations right now with the apartments around the campus, making sure that there's a conversation. Our campus police, their jurisdiction goes out beyond the borders of the campus to be able to police that. Our fraternities and sororities will be doing recruitment virtually as opposed to doing live events. And we're going to alter on-campus events or parties and that sort of thing following the county health department's guidelines for whatever phase, if we're in phase two or phase three. So we are working through a lot of those things. What we know is traditional college life will look different if we are able to come back, and yet students will have some autonomy, be potentially in residence halls, in classes, and getting the education, a high quality education that they want and deserve.
Yeah. On the one hand, some college students are very young. I think one of you said 17. I didn't get in until 18, but okay, 17, sometimes younger than 17, actually. And they, of course, are young and believe that they are invincible, and they want the college experience that they have heard so much about, particularly in their high school years, in anticipating going off to school. They are, by nature, social creatures, gregarious, young people. On the other hand, they're going to college. They're smart enough to get into one of your institutions. They should be, one thinks, smart enough to understand what's happening with this virus and act accordingly. Should they be held accountable for that, or should they be forgiven, given the example being set by many adults that they are witnessing on television and in real life, Dr. Gaber?
Well, I think there's a careful blend there. What we have, and we have the Niner Pledge. Students are making a pledge when they are able to come back that they will uphold all of the standards and expectations. Students also, we have within our code of student responsibility that they will be held responsible for wearing a mask in a classroom, inside buildings, that they won't be in large gatherings. We will have the opportunity to work through that code of responsibility to remove individuals from our campus community as needed. And I think what we've all said is there's a shift in our role of having to make sure that the students are policing themselves and that we are appropriately maintaining a healthy campus.
There was a report this morning that worldwide there is an education deficit coming out of what happened last spring. And I think they focused in their study on the lower grades. But I am curious as to what you think the impact will be for these college students, who some of them are depending on these degrees to get a good job. Others are depending upon them to get into graduate schools and pursue even higher education. So I'd like to hear from Presidents Armbruster and Lugo on this, because you made the difficult decision to go all virtual this fall. Yep. Do you think this will have any lasting impact on these students' educations?
I'd like to think not. One of the things that we've done in opening up about 2 weeks later than we had even originally planned on our previous schedule is to provide our faculty with opportunities for additional professional development. One of the legacies of this will be that the modality of delivering instruction is going to change forever. And that if you're not in a position to deliver instruction in ways other than face-to-face, then you're going to be behind the time. So we are kind of leaning into that. We know that when we made the very, very rash decisions in March to go all virtual, that we probably weren't as prepared to deliver the quality of instruction that we could have. So to the extent that there may have been a deficit, I might concede the point. We are trying to make sure that we overcome those deficits with a very intensive professional development. Our faculty are in the midst of 3 weeks of training that have been designed by our Senior Vice President of Academic Affairs. And we hope that notwithstanding the fact that we won't be face-to-face, that we're going to overcome that deficit. But all things being equal, I think it's much better. And I think all of us would agree that we'd be in front of our students on a regular basis. But the world is going to change.
President Lugo, what's your take on that? Are these kids going to realize this is a setback to them in some way for long-term?
Yeah, you know, I actually think that I have a multi-part answer to the question. From Queens's perspective, as we pivoted to virtual online instruction in the spring, you know, we did an incredible amount of surveying at the end of that experience. And we have data to show that the academic experience was strong. Some of that has to do that we had experience with online education prior to that, and that helped. And now going into the fall, we've had a lot of time to prepare. One of the things that I think is critically important about our decision is the avoidance of disruption, right? The avoidance of multiple move-ins, packing up, moving this, doing that. What our students know what the expectation is for the fall semester. And then knock on wood, boy, I'm nervous even saying this, our technology platform has been very, very consistent. So the actual loss that I most worry about is that social, that mental health, that connectivity that is very, very real, quantifiable, and we're seeing it and concerns me deeply. I do think that there are academic and professional development losses that are being experienced across the landscape in higher education, but I'm very, very proud of Queens's response and how we've mitigated that and put together a very competitive academic program going forward.
There are many institutions of higher learning in this area. We couldn't have them all on because even in the Zoom world, there's not enough space for them all. But I want to go through some of the decisions that some of these other institutions have made. Belmont Abbey is holding socially distanced classes along with online instruction with masks required. Davidson College plans to use indoor and outdoor spaces so that classes can meet with adequate social distancing and blend that in with online instruction as well. But their residence halls and their dining facilities at Davidson will be open or are open. Central Piedmont Community College is offering online and in-person classes as well as hybrid blended courses with a mask requirement. And Winthrop is resorting to something they're calling pivot plans. In-class instruction, with no testing requirement for students coming into those classes, and they will be providing health kits to students, including masks. Since you, Dr. Gaber, made the decision not to go back until at least October the 1st, are these schools making a mistake?
Oh, I'm not in a position to judge what they're planning in their situation.
I knew that would be your answer. But go ahead. I don't want to interrupt your answer.
Well, thank you. I think that every campus has looked at what is their planning, what are they prepared to do, and you know, as has been mentioned, what is the risk that they're willing to take. And for us, we have listened closely to our students, our student government, to the health department, and to our system to ensure that we are prudently following a course that we feel is safe and appropriate. So I'm optimistic that every campus has gone through that sort of process.
You may have already addressed this to a certain degree, President Lugo, but one of the questions that Queen's University asked of itself as it struggled to make this very difficult decision, I don't want to minimize it in any way, because it, for all three of you, this is a monstrously difficult decision, but you had to ask whether or not to have students return to campus. The question was whether you would be able to effectively execute on what you call the Royal Return Plan, which depends heavily, you say, on your ability to test everyone before initial campus entry and to implement a program for weekly randomized testing to quickly identify, contact, trace, and isolate asymptomatic cases as they developed. Did you feel you couldn't do that, and that's why you decided that going back to classes in person would not be possible?
No, that was a part of the decision. At the time, again, we made our go or no-go decision back on July 31st. Part of that had to do with the migration of our students from around the world and around the country and not wanting folks to arrive that didn't need to arrive and to not compromise their health choices when we knew they were probably going to need to stay home. But we're very, very proud of the Royal Return Plan that we developed in partnership with Novant Health, who have preeminent leadership in the national landscape around epidemiology and public health, partnering with Dr. Williams and Dr. Breger. We felt very, very strong about our program that did incorporate testing, an ingestion point of testing for students to get, as much of the virus not arriving at our campus as possible. And then, yes, survey testing. Now, as we are learning from experiences going forward, that testing we will still have for the spring, but it might look a little bit different. And I'm actually very excited about game-changing announcements that we we're experiencing right now around very, very highly sensitive and accurate tests that are now being approved by the FDA that instead of costing $150 or $140 are costing $5 or $10. I mean, I'm familiar with a school that pre-bought 60,000 tests, right, for their community to execute in the fall semester. And that was a $6 million cost where we might make the same choice and it'll be a $300,000 decision with $5 tests. So, I think it's important to learn from the landscape and keep improving the plan because we're going to need it in the spring.
I know that you're a private school, but where does that money come from? How can any university or college afford millions of dollars for testing?
Well, I think it depends on their model. And I don't want to comment again on everyone's financial model, but their business made it appropriate for them to take the capital risk of making that type of investment to ensure that they could have a safe fall semester. By the way, we did not make that gigantic of an investment. That would not be the cost that would be associated with our original survey plan. But we may be able to be a lot more aggressive if tests are saliva-based and $5.
So, Dr. Gaber, you may go back October the 1st. I'm just curious what metrics you intend to use to make that decision.
And it will be a number of metrics. We're going to look at how the trends are running here in Mecklenburg County. We're going to see what has happened in the residence halls, what's going on our campus. There'll be a conversation with the county health department. There'll be a further conversation with the UNC system. So we'll be looking at lots of different data points.
And Dr. Armbruster, I don't know if you have a target date for coming back. Maybe it's next semester. I'm not sure. But the same question to you, what metrics will you use to decide that?
Right. Our target date is hopefully to reopen in the spring semester. And our target metrics would include the contagion in Mecklenburg County and the contagion in the hotspots from which our students draw. You mentioned early in our discussion, we draw a number of students from a lot of the southeastern United States. And in those areas were particularly hot. And you think of places like Florida, Georgia, even our neighboring state in South Carolina. So those will be among the metrics that we look at. And we're very hopeful that we can return face-to-face in the spring.
And Dr. Lugo, I have 10 seconds. A similar plan?
Very similar. And an emphasis on being able to execute on our testing plan.
Okay. We're coming right back with our three college presidents in just a moment, a chancellor and two presidents in just a moment in Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fifth Third Bank, dedicated to the financial empowerment of the community by investing time, resources, and people in the Charlotte area and throughout the state. More at 53.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about colleges going back to school or going online for the fall semester, and why and what this all means to them and what it means to their students. Dr. Sharon Gaber is with us, the new chancellor at UNC Charlotte, who took office on the 20th of July, only to have to confront this. President Clarence Armbruster is with Johnson C. Smith University, and President Daniel Lugo is with Queens University of Charlotte. Dr. Armbruster, the virus, like so many other things in America, has had a disproportionate impact on the African-American community and other minorities. In fact, the CDC reports African-Americans are 2.5 times more likely to die of COVID-19 than whites. Historically, black colleges and universities were already under a difficult operating situation before this virus, we ever knew about this virus. What impact is this having on HBCUs?
Well, it's having a significant impact. As you mentioned, financial strains are but one of the consequences that have resulted from the virus. Fortunately, we have a leader and a champion in Congresswoman Alma Adams, who is the founder of the bipartisan and bicameral HBCU caucus, which was instrumental in getting significant funding directed to HBCUs and other minority serving institutions. So we were very fortunate to be able to qualify for much of that funding. And that funding will be very helpful through this year. The challenge will be the following years, and we do three-year budgeting, and we know there are going to be some challenges there. But as for the direct effects of the virus on the health and welfare of our students and their families, it is a very, very unfortunate and deleterious effect on them. Many of our students live in conditions where their families are that they can't easily socially distance, and it becomes a problem. And so that's why it was such a tough decision for us to say that we did not want the students to come on campus. Because in many instances, the campus is probably, and for many, a better place for them. But the risks, as Dr. Lugo mentioned, were just too great to bring everybody back here on campus and suffer through what might be an outbreak that we couldn't control.
Do you also share some of the same concerns that CMS has about access to technology and access to appropriate study locations in the home for young people?
Absolutely. Many of our students don't have their own room or desks that they can find quiet space to study. And so that was a concern, and we're very hopeful and prayerful that we'll be able to get back in the spring. We have been able, through some of the monies we've gotten through the CARES Act, to make sure we can provide Wi-Fi, high-speed internet access for our students. Every freshman gets a device, an iPad, when they enter Johnson C. Smith, even before this pandemic. Mm-hmm. And we are taking requests from students who need equipment, whether it's a laptop, cameras, things like that, to make sure that they'll be able to access the education we're going to provide.
Dan Lugo, do you face similar challenges at Queens, or are you exempt from those?
No, not at all. I think our student body is very representative of the American landscape and the Charlotte region, with great socioeconomic diversity and great ethnic diversity. And a couple of things of that. One, I'd say the digital divide is something that the country finally needs to address. It is as important as healthcare and other things, and it's really being laid bare right in front of us. What access to high-speed internet and technology is doing, and that's something that the Knight School of Communication and Digital Charlotte, a major initiative that we lead, has been screaming about for a long time. But yes, we actually have a number of students on campus that I would describe as they've made a case for their hardship access to Wi-Fi, or the multi-generational nature of their households and not wanting to expose grandparents. And so we have a cohort of students that are still living in our dorms, and we're very, very happy that they're there, they're safe, and they're, working online.
Let's talk about something we haven't talked about that is really important to student life and also very important to alumni, and to how they kick in money back to your educational institutions, and that is sports, mm-hmm. athletics. Queens, President Armbruster has canceled sports this fall. Johnson C. Smith, canceled all homecoming activities way back in July. What have you decided about athletics?
Well, we are members of the CIAA conference, which, as you know, has hosted, among other things, the largest basketball gathering here in Charlotte for each of the last 15 years. The conference, and actually at the recommendation of our athletic directors, who I think made a very courageous decision well before we made the decision to go online, indicated that we would not have any fall sports this semester. So we've been on record since about the mid-June of not having any sports. It was a very, very tough decision, but we think it was the right decision. We're still contemplating what activities we might be able to have in the spring, but that's where we are in terms of our athletic events.
Dr. Gaber, UNC Charlotte appears to be proceeding with athletics and with 49er football. Why do you feel comfortable that can happen in this environment?
Well, I think like everything, it is a constantly changing landscape. What we know right now is Conference USA, which is the conference that we are a part of, has agreed to proceed with football, but all other fall sports have been postponed until the spring.
So, is that because football is the money sport? And we need the
Well,
money.
I think it's because they probably have been practicing the longest. So they came back before other student athletes. So we are proceeding at this point. I will tell you that between our athletics director and myself, we seem to be on phone calls with Conference USA, each of us about twice a week. And you've probably heard that our first home game at this point, we have said there will not be any fans in attendance. Right. And in part because we will not have anybody on campus, and that potentially would be the weekend that students would be moving back to campus.
And President Lugo, I mentioned Queens had canceled all of their fall sports. What will be the impact of that on your school?
That's a great question. And our decision wasn't in isolation. We're proud members of the South Atlantic Conference that has postponed all fall sports. And we are working on rescheduling those for the spring, which will be a big lift. And athletics is a huge component of the Queens experience. We are a scholarship-granting Division II dominant program. We're in the top 10 of Learfield Cup for Division II, and 40% of our undergraduate students are actually varsity athletes. So this is a major front for us. And a real hat tip to our coaches who have kept that community connected. They still agree that the best place for them to play is to be on a royal roster, and to the best place for them to get an education is at Queens. So we're not seeing attrition there, but it's a big factor to this. And by the way, I'm a fan of I've been to UNC Charlotte games and I've been to Bulls games, and so I'm hoping that we all weather this storm, because athletics is a huge part of the traditions of university and college experiences.
Cindy on Facebook writes, as the current faculty president at JCSU, I know I speak for the faculty when I say we appreciate the decision made by the administration and the Board of Trustees to put the health and safety of faculty, staff, and students first. I know you appreciate that comment, President.
I do, Armstrong. From our faculty president, I do.
Yeah. on campuses that opened and had to close, the reason was the outbreak of the virus, and much of that was driven by irresponsible behavior by students, no question. But surely college's administrators had an inkling that this might happen and that it would be incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to subdue that kind of behavior. Yet they still opened their campuses, only to have to close them. So Nate Silver of 538, the website, has called that both predictable and predicted. And he recently tweeted, what some colleges are doing isn't so far from a bait and switch. Lay out implausible conditions under which college could commence without COVID spread. Get tuition on the premise of an in-person experience. Blame students when the conditions are inevitably violated. And then go online. Any response to that, Dr. Gaber?
Well, I think that is why we've attempted to proactively indicate we're looking at the health and well-being. We didn't have students move in and then do the bait and switch. We're trying to work through what does the data look like, what's happening in Mecklenburg County and in the broader region, and ensure that we're doing what's right for health and well-being. So I hear it, but I think collectively in this group of presidents and chancellor, we're looking at health and safety issues.
Yeah. Well, Brett Devereaux, who's an assistant teaching professor of history at NC State, wrote in The Atlantic about the situation. He says universities backed themselves into, and he says colleges couldn't afford to do the right thing because it would mean financial suicide. But your three organizations did what he called the right thing. Do you think that's a fair characterization, President Armbrister?
Well, as we've talked about before, we've all made decisions that were in the best interest of our institution. From a financial standpoint, believe me, if finances were at the forefront of what we were considering, we might not have made this decision. And for that, I thank our board, who at the outset of this process worked with the administration and developed a series of guiding principles, and the first of which was the health and safety of our community. So that was always our North Star. And I'd like to think that there were not deleterious motives in the other institutions, that they thought generally that they really could open up and be safe. As Dr. Lugo mentioned and others have mentioned, Chancellor Gaber, is that we've evaluated the risk and made decisions that were in our best interest, and I don't ascribe any ulterior motives to those other institutions.
So Brett Devereaux gets into detail over his condemnation, and it leads into a discussion on how education is financed and the need for more instructors, which increases the cost of education, which then is financed by more student loans. And prior to the pandemic, everybody was talking about how student loans have become unaffordable. And one of the Democratic candidates wanted to forgive student loans going forward. He has some suggestions on reforming things, but we don't have time to go into them. But do you believe, President Lugo, that this pandemic will result in some sort of serious examination and with changes in the whole college financial situation?
I hope so. I think this is an important opportunity. And, I appreciate Nate Silver and I appreciate Dr. Devereaux. I'm happy that you're speaking with college presidents that actually do this work versus prognosticators that don't. His point about the financing model of how we educate our nation for a 21st century competitive worldwide workforce has to be reviewed. The percentage of those costs that is now being borne on families is definitely very, very concerning. I do think that we need to think about the public good that education does that we are seeing right now. Because apparently, when anyone says that, hey, we won't have it, it is a national emergency for people that don't work in this business to opine on it. So clearly, it is an incredibly important aspect of the American experience and how we educate our workforce. So we need to put our money where our mouth is. And states and the federal government need to step in to lessen the burden on our families.
Mike, if I could just piggyback on Dan's point, I think he's so right about education being a public good. And I am hopeful that these series of events and calamities will return to public investment in education at all levels, but particularly higher education, particularly for our students, 75% who are Pell Grant eligible, the need to reinvest in those students so that they can get a high quality education is not important only to those students, but it's important to society as well.
I only have a couple of minutes left, but I want to talk about the other side of this equation. We talked a lot about student life, et cetera, but what about the faculty? I'm hearing that this process of having to create online versions of courses that that teachers have been teaching in the classroom, and sometimes having to create both versions because it's a blended situation, is creating an incredible amount of work. And some of that work is not compensated because a lot of institutions are depending on adjunct faculty who are only paid by the course. They are not paid by the hour, and many of them don't get benefits. How many of your students, how many of your faculty are adjunct professors? Dr. Gaber.
I don't have that specific number right now.
But you have a significant number, all three of you. Would you say that's true?
I'd say that for us, we have some percentage and a large percentage of tenure track faculty members also.
Do you think people understand that these people are asked to do all this extra work for absolutely no compensation, and the federal government set aside money for colleges and universities to help them weather this crisis? I'm curious how much of that money went to any of those people versus infrastructure.
Well, so CARES Act money for us went both directly to students to assist with their costs and their needs, and then it's also gone to a number of things to help. For example, we're setting up an on-campus testing site. It'll help us funding that. It'll help with some of the costs, for example, having to reimburse proactively from when students moved out of residence halls. A lot of the money that came in we've used for things directly related to costs that were incurred. Your point about faculty, though, is that the faculty have been amazing and remarkable, and you're absolutely right. And we've talked a lot about the shift in teaching modality and how our faculty have really stepped up to the plate in doing this.
I wish we had more time because I know that the North Carolina educators from kindergarten up have asked state lawmakers for $350 million more. And I'm curious how, if that's even going to make a dent given the number of academic institutions we have in North Carolina. But we don't have time. Dr. Sharon Gaber, Chancellor of UNC Charlotte, President Clarence Armbrister of Johnson C. Smith University, and President Daniel Lugo from Queens University of Charlotte. Good luck with the semester. Thank you all for being here. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.